Hey, welcome to Our Altered World. If you've been feeling overwhelmed by the giant that is climate change, you're not alone. I'm Neil, and here we celebrate the inspiring work of individuals and organizations making real positive strides that you may not have heard about. My hope is for our conversations here to make you feel inspired and reconnected to our planet. And with that being said, I would love to introduce Frank Pope, the CEO of Save the Elephants.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Frank. I would love for you to tell our listeners a bit about yourself and how did you first become interested in conservation and what brought you to work for Save the Elephants?
Well, I think I was always interested in animals and the outside world. I was especially interested by the ocean early in my life. I did my degree in zoology and went into marine conservation and was working a lot at sea and was for about 10 years. But over that time, I think like a lot of people working in marine science at that time and even now just saw an immense amount of change in the wrong direction happening. And I felt like what was needed, what I wanted to do was turn a bit more to advocacy. So I turned to journalism and a very wonderful editor at the Times newspaper in London went out on a limb and hired me as the world's first ocean correspondent. So I got to spend a few years writing about the science and environment of the ocean and advocating for change. And that was wonderful. And then by that stage, I was living in Kenya, and this was 22. I'd married the daughter of one who in many ways was the godfather of elephant conservation, a guy called Ian Douglas Hamilton. He's the sort of the Jane Goodall of elephant world, if you like. And he was the first to study elephants in their natural habitat. And he was running this fantastic organization called Save the Elephants, which I was not involved in at all. But 2012 was a very dark time for elephants because of a resurgent ivory trade that had taken hold across Africa, and elephants were being decimated in many habitats across Africa. And at the time, Ian was predicting that we stood to lose elephants from the wild entirely within a generation, which for an elephant as iconic as an animal as iconic as elephants would really have been catastrophic. And he lost his chief operating officer at the time. And I thought, okay, well, I've got a background in running projects. I'll jump in and help him and just get him through this sticky phase and just help out. And I was blown away, actually, by the experience of where I'd never worked with mammals on land before. I'd lots of encounters with mammals in the sea, and just the parallels of these giant sentient beings living giant unfenced lives across northern Kenya. You know, I could see lots of parallels with the ocean and quickly became hooked, and I've never been able to leave. But it's fascinating.
That's incredible. What a transitionary period for you for working in all these different aspects of conservation from the seas to land. I know the name is very self-descriptive as it is. However, how would you best describe what Save the Elephants is to everyone listening here today?
Save the Elephants was actually born more as a research organization than to be out there battling for elephants. But Ian had a very long-sighted view. You know, he's been studying elephants for 60 years. And I think the best way of describing what we do is we try to give elephants a voice in a very fast-changing world. Researchers were at the core, so we're trying to understand elephants as best we can in order to help other people understand their world and to live alongside them. And it's this combination of data and science together with empathy and storytelling that is was a major component in delivering elephants from the threat of the ivory trade, and it's going to be very much a core part of securing them a future in the face of all the challenges that they have today: habitat loss, climate change, and the still a lurking threat of the ivory trade. So really what we try and do is we don't have a particular park. We have a research center where we're very invested in the elephants that are there, but we're trying to learn lessons about elephants, deepen our understanding of their world, and develop solutions that can help them across their entire range across Africa and work collaboratively with organizations across the continent in order to secure a future for them.
You've just touched base on some topics there regarding threats, for example, ivory trade, as well as environmental issues, particularly relating to climate change. How is climate change particularly impacting elephant populations and their habitat, especially in regard to the research that Save the Elephants has done, and what have they found in this?
Yeah, so as always with climate change, it's a little bit of a frog in hot water situation where you're not quite sure where the dividing line between weather and climate is, but elephants elephants are incredibly adaptable creatures, and they once lived across almost the entirety of the African continent. In fact, they lived on most continents on the planet. Their disappearance, as in all their different genera type, intersects quite well with the arrival of humans. But if we just think about elephants in Africa, they have been largely displaced from the very fertile areas that have been good for farming. And so they now exist on the peripheries, the band of the Sahel across the top of Africa, and the Congo Basin, where the forest elephants live, which is also threatened by climate change, in as much as if humans impact the forest too much, it can dry out, and very rapidly that will be exacerbated by climate change. So elephants are sort of on the edge environmentally, and that makes them more susceptible. And what we've seen in northern Kenya, for example, is an escalating cycle of drought and flood, the same as we've got elsewhere in the world. And we just came out of 3 years of very strong drought where people were really suffering, a lot of wildlife suffering. Elephants actually didn't do too badly in this one because they're so adaptable and they can travel long distances. And then that's quickly what comes on the heels of that drought is overwhelming flood. What we're interested in is when it comes to our research, with a couple of different strands. One is to really investigate, elephants are adaptable, they can exist in a range of habitats, but what are their thresholds? How hot can they be before they're not able to survive? And one of the key elements that elephants need is standing water. They need to be able to drink. They can't extract enough moisture from the plants they eat to survive. So they are anchored at water sources. And the fate of those water sources is a key area of interest for us in order, how do we determine and model what habitats are going to be open to elephants in the future as you project the impacts of climate change.
At either end of that threshold that you just mentioned regarding the elephant, what would be occurring? So let's say the temperature is getting extremely high and they can't cope. What is the result of that? And then what is the antithesis of that when there's extreme amounts of flooding and their habitat has been changed in a way that they're not used to?
The most impactful effect of climate change for elephants is actually going to be the behavior of humans. So northern Kenya is a pastoralist landscape where you've got people living in a semi-arid system with elephants. And as climate change, together with the grazing pressure of those people, if in a drought situation, you can end up with the land getting overgrazed very rapidly, and then the flood comes in, strips away the topsoil, and you could end up in a situation where that landscape is no longer able to support either so many elephants, but coincidentally actually supports less livestock, which act against elephants' interests in many ways. So because elephants are so adaptable, it's not a straight line. You could end up with climate change benefiting elephants in some areas, but definitely it could drive them out of it.
Incredibly interesting. I want to also trace back to the earlier mentioned regarding the ivory trade. There's been a lot of governmental changes regarding ivory trade and the way the world has viewed ivory trade, particularly, let's say, in the past decade. Is that still a current threat to elephants? And I want to link this into some of the anti-poaching techniques, and what are the current reasons and rationales behind, do you think, the changes in poaching have occurred over the past 10 years?
Yeah, so the ivory trade, it's a long story, but it's best I give you a quick primer, because there are really two phases of the ivory crisis when it comes to elephants. One took us all the way up until the end of the 80s, and that was the era of legal ivory hunting. And that stretched back hundreds of years, thousands of years, if you take it back to China and their appetite for carving ivory. All that time, up until the 1980s, trade in ivory was legal and people were getting rich on it, and it was all legal. And Europe was involved. America was very much involved. It was all, they were making billiard balls. They were making ivory keys for pianos. Inlays in furniture, all sorts of combs, all sorts of devices, especially pre-plastic. Ivory was an incredibly useful material, and it's a wonderfully hard material. It's easy to carve and so on. By the end of the 80s, it was seen that Ian was the founder of Save the Elephants, was right at the tip of the spear, pointing out, hey guys, this is unsustainable. We are going to lose elephants from Africa unless we stop this. And there was an enormous amount of resistance to that idea that the offtake was unsustainable, because those ivory sales at least in East Africa, were the main thing that were funding conservation. These ivory sales were funding the national parks. Anyway, in the light of the data that became available and that then started collecting, that the international trade was banned in 1989, and we had this kind of 20-year golden period where elephants were no longer in danger for the ivory they carried in their tusks. And then what transpired is the sort of second era of the ivory trade, which was the illegal trade in ivory. And this was fueled really because China, which had this long tradition of valuing ivory, but had previously been, people had been too poor to buy much of it. They had this economic explosion in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s. And suddenly people that couldn't have dreamed of buying ivory wanted it and had the ability to get it. And this enormous illegal trade, smuggling ivory into China, developed. And we were into this secondary crisis, which really spanned from sort of 2008 is when we started feeling it.
Frank, I'm just going to pause you right there. We're going to take our first break to hear from our station sponsors, and we'll be back soon.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered Worlds. I'm here with Frank Pope, the CEO of Save the Elephants. We just left off on a brief recap of the history of the ivory trade and the relay of where it ended up in the early 2000s with an economic boom in China and the plight of the illegal ivory trade, which then flooded across the Indian Ocean into China. So, Frank, please continue on your story of how the ivory trade affected elephants in the past, where you guys are at the moment, and what Save the Elephants is doing in terms of anti-poaching measures.
Sure. So we had this flow of illegal ivory going into China, and we were suddenly seeing this wave of poaching across the African continent as the trafficking syndicates, the crime syndicates, started saying, okay, here's a product that can fetch us a lot of money. We can buy it cheap in Africa. We can sell it. We're the ones who will take the risk of getting it across the borders, and we'll sell it for good profit in China. So ivory became a trafficked good alongside drugs, illegal counterfeit pharmaceuticals, people, weapons, all of these things. These are the high-value items that these smuggling syndicates get rich off. So we were left, and we started seeing elephants getting killed in national parks in East Africa, and we knew that there'd been heavy pressure in the forest for a while longer. And we were left with this terrible situation where the legal instruments that had been set up to protect elephants were now failing. And we were left with an equivalent of the drugs war, but this time elephant lives were at stake. And they were the ones that were going to disappear if we got this wrong. And at this point was when we needed to come together as a global gathering of individuals, scientists, actors, activists, and organizations and governments all came together, and there were a lot of players involved. And this had to be a big collaborative effort, otherwise it would have never worked on the scale that it did. Save the Elephants was right at the heart of this because of the data that we were able to gather and empathy for elephants that we're able to create by introducing people to their world at our study site in Samburu, northern Kenya, which is in many ways a sort of an embassy for elephants. So what ended up happening is we were brought together by the Clintons as a community. Bill Clinton had come to our camp, and Hillary Clinton had her Clinton Global Initiative, and she had the convening power and the access to the US government to unite everyone around three basic strategies. And you asked about anti-poaching before. Anti-poaching is really important, but it can't work on its own because the poachers in Africa are much maligned, and you know, of course, it's a terrible thing, poaching as an activity, but the poachers themselves are often local people. They live far from cities. They're bush people. They live rural lives. And someone appears in their village and goes, "Hey, if you guys will bring me ivory, I will give you this much money." And this is the outer tendrils of the trafficking networks. And these people, they may be aware that it's a crime. They may not be aware that it's a crime. It may be something of a tradition that they can bend the rules slightly, the cultural rules slightly, and go and kill an elephant. So they will then supply the traffickers. So yes, you have to improve law enforcement to keep a lid on the poaching, but there are enough poor young men in Africa, across the elephant range, that if you just concentrated on anti-poaching, you would never win. Because if there's something that's worth money, people will go to great lengths to acquire it. So you can't just focus on the poaching. And when we were faced with this rising wave, we were thinking, okay, well, the other elements of the plan that we agreed under Hillary Clinton's convening was, well, we need to take on the traffickers. We need to disrupt those trafficking networks. But equally, we know that the war on drugs has not worked. And as long as something is valued and people are going to pay money for it, there are going to be criminals out there that are going to take risks to smuggle it. So in the end, the pivotal piece that we have to get right is to stop people wanting to buy ivory. And the main place people were buying it was China. So how do we then convince China, soon to be the world's most populous nation with a history of valuing ivory going back thousands of years, how do we, a Western NGO and a Western movement, convince them to stop buying ivory? And we thought that was going to be a generational struggle. We thought that was going to take decades. And it was, I think, one of the great untold environmental success stories that we should all be proud of around the world, together with the US government, UK government, and European governments around the world. They didn't point fingers at China and say, you're the ones to blame. They said, we're all to blame for this. And the US government had a large, by number of pieces, trade in ivory in some parts of their Chinatowns in big cities that they could point to and say, hey, look, it's not just you, it's us. Joint hands, Obama and Xi Jinping joined hands, and together they agreed to ban the trade within their borders. So it was no longer just an international ban, it was now a ban within China. And to China's enormous credit, they have stuck with that law and they have enforced that law. And there is today very little ivory trade that we know of and that we can pick up on within China. There are still some problems along the borders where Chinese tourists come across the borders and in less well-enforced countries along, you know, Myanmar. The trade within China, which was the crucial piece to get right, has been got right. As of beginning of 2018, that trade was stopped there. And we've seen poaching reduce dramatically across the continent of Africa as a result. So that's a sort of long-winded answer to your question about, you know, what place anti-poaching. Really important, but as part of a as part of a wider strategy.
No, it's fantastic. And I love the metaphor that you used in between that as a reference to the comparison between the war on drugs. And I thought that was very well said. With Save the Elephants, you've mentioned multiple times the work that you guys have done in terms of research, particularly on elephant behavior, intelligence. Can you share some of the most fantastic or fascinating discoveries that the research you guys have done has revealed?
Yeah, so elephants are probably the best studied, certainly one of the best studied animals on the planet. They're big, they're conspicuous. Everyone loves elephants, and they can carry a big sensor payload as well. So we've discovered, so we do a lot of tracking of elephants, and you can get a very good idea about what they're up to using GPS trackers that we can give them collars with these sensor payloads, and I think there are lots of insights that come from lots of different areas. I think one of the real high point last year was the discovery or the proving for us that elephants use names for one another. So they use abstract names for one another. This research that was led at our study site in Samburu was the first time in any non-human animal that this was proved. And
I remember reading about this at the time.
Yeah, it was sort of the good news story of the day. You know, the world is falling apart, but don't worry, because elephants have. it's really the story of how you prove that. So, like a lot of things with elephants, if you have the enormous privilege of spending time with elephants, and you get a very deep sense of their intelligence, you can kind of intuit their intelligence. And when you watch a herd, they're endlessly fascinating to watch. There's so much going on. And the more you know about them, especially if you recognize them as individuals and you know their family history as we do, their world starts to open up and you start to see stuff and wonder how things happen, and wonder what is happening and start projecting things on elephants. Proving this is a very different matter. So you could see that maybe one elephant makes a rumble and another one turns around and you think, hey, can I just call her name? But proving it is a very different matter. So there was and proving it relies on knowing who is who within the herd. And it relies on the kind of microphones that are able to capture the subsonic frequencies that elephants use when they call. It also relies on enormous speakers that you put in the car when you're doing the playback study to know that if the name...
Are they going
to
turn their heads?
So it's a fascinating study. There's lots of it online about how we did it, but it was Mickey Pardo, the lead researcher on that from Cornell, just did a fantastically rigorous job on that. I think set a path that, and we're now discovering that in other animals, that this is also the case. And as The Economist magazine memorably put it, anything that knocks anthropocentric exceptionalism on the head is a good thing. We should think we're special. And the more we discover the animal world, the more we realize we're not special. There's a continuum. And elephants are part of that continuum. And that's sort of philosophically why this research is so important to do, because we need the world to be behind elephants and to want to have a world that has creatures like elephants in it. And in order for that to happen, we need to appreciate them and understand the complexity of their world. Mm-hmm. So that the naming study was one exciting one. I think a constant source of fascination is elephants and their attitude to death. Most animals will, they're very social. If you're a social animal, you're very interested in your kind when they're still alive. But if someone drops dead, they're ignored. Most animals will just, they then just ignore their death. Elephants are very different. And we'll often find carcasses of elephants that have died recently from whatever cause. And you'll go back to the site in a few weeks later, and you'll see that it is ringed. All the grass has disappeared in that area and it's ringed by elephant dung, meaning that lots of elephants have spent lots of time in the presence of that elephant. And we've started looking into that more deeply now with the benefit of knowing who is who and new camera trap technology, and really peering into the details of what is happening there. And I think there's a deep story about to break in that world.
I remember... I think it was either 2015 or 2016, there was the David Attenborough documentary, Africa, and it had followed a herd of elephants. I may be remembering this wrong, but there was a moment in time where there was someone who was injured in the group, and it was evident that they were going to pass away. And there was another elephant that was almost mourning the death of this elephant live on our screens. And it was quite viscerally impactful. And it's a shame that I can't remember it completely now, but I remember watching that moment and thinking, oh, like it was so deeply connective for seeing that sort of reflection of comparison of like our lives as humans reflected back in these animal experiences.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's a very moving sight, and you can't help mapping your emotions onto what they're feeling. And I think it's a very tempting thing to do. It's a dangerous thing to do because we're familiar with our own emotions. But I think as time goes by and we spend more time and understand more about what is going on and what is actually going on in the elephant's brain, again, the exceptionalism will tumble. We will find that this emotion is shared, and it's transparent to you or I if we're there and we witness it, what is going on.
I did like something that you just mentioned there in terms of the danger of projecting emotions. And it's something that had been quite an issue when it came to chimpanzee study with the idea of smiling. So a lot of times we think, oh, we're smiling and we're happy. But chimps, for example, grimace if they're worried, if they're scared. And that's, again, a projection of emotion, thinking, oh, they're happy in this environment. But in reality, it was the research that made us have that learning of being like, oh, no, it's not. This is a dissimilar behavior. This is not something that they're doing in reflection of how we would react.
Yeah, exactly. And then there are, I suppose I'd point to a couple of other bits of research that are of interest. One was a small investigation. It started as a small investigation as to whether it was true. It seemed to be true that elephants avoided trees that had bees in them. And we thought, is this true? And it did turn out to be true that, you know, elephants are famous destroyers of trees.
Yeah, bees.
And yes, the bees could protect trees. And we looked into it further, and it turned out that elephants are scared of bees. In fact, not even bees themselves. You could play the sound of bees and they will run. And this
It's the problem with droning at the moment as well, isn't it? If the drones sound like bees to them, so they get scared. Is that correct?
Well, we can get in. Yeah, we'll get into that, I think, because that's a new line of we're looking at using how to use drones as a research platform. And it is a distressing sound to them, but it's also a useful thing. We turned it into a useful conservation technology in that Lucy King, who's our director of coexistence, did her PhD on turning elephants' fear of bees into a beehive fence. And you can
round. Gonna have to read this.
A small scale farm. In fact, you can do other things with it too, like protect corridors. But the PhD was all on using as protecting small scale farms. You string beehives around a small scale farm, and you attach the beehives with a wire, and you allow the beehives to swing. So they're not solidly attached, they're suspended. And if an elephant tries to get into the farm, touches the wire, pushes the beehives, which swing, aggravates the bees, which come out and chase the elephant away.
It sounds terrifying. It honestly sounds terrifying.
Yeah. We just published a 9-year study on this, and more than 80% of the time the elephants run away from the farm, and the farmers end up with honey to sell, and they get their crops pollinated to boot. And it's a sustainable solution that is now being used in, I think, over 24 countries, with hundreds and hundreds of farms being protected by these beehive fences. So this research can, you never know quite where it's going to come from, but it can lead to really wonderful solutions.
No, incredible. It's like the ingenuity and creativity working in conjunction with the science there. I do love that. I think it's time for us to take another quick break and hear from our station sponsors, and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role, just to stay busy. But every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered Worlds. I'm here with Frank Pope, the CEO of Save the Elephant. We just left off on talking about how incredibly creative some of the past research and work of those working with Save the Elephant have produced in changing the way that we look at conservation and our learning behind the science that the research has led to. I'm currently working as an advisor for Colossal Biosciences, and I'm aware that the company is working with an AI model project with Save the Elephants to help with your identifying and tracking and monitoring of elephants that you've already mentioned. What are your hopes for this project and your work with Colossal?
Yeah, thanks. Colossal were out of the blue for us, and it was they've been wonderful partners because they're very experienced in the realm of artificial intelligence and leveraging that, and they've really helped us put some effort into fundamental investigations into elephant behavior. And their interest, I think, was because they're flagship species that they want to bring back is the mammoth, and therefore they want to understand the behavior of elephants better and help us push the frontier of what we know about elephants. Our thinking was we've got 60 years now of studying elephants from land cruisers, from vehicles, and with humans looking at elephants from vehicles. And there's a lot you can establish, and we have established in that way. But a lot of the data ends up being qualitative. You can say who's near to who, what you think their relative body posture is, but you're pretty limited by elephants being behind cover. You can't see who's in the herd all the time. You certainly can't. It's very difficult to measure, say, relative orientations and so on. So what we wanted to do was see, could we use a drone, put a drone up above and film elephants from on top and study elephants in the same way that researchers studying smaller mammals might film animals from above, and you can then study, you can look at relative body orientations, introduce actors into the scene, see what happens, and study every animal at the same time. This might sound sort of slightly academic, but it leads to absolutely fascinating applications and ability to answer questions. But I think big picture, where this will get us is it'll give us quantitative data rather than qualitative data. It'll give quantitative data that we can feed in and have that put into AI in an unsupervised way. So we know what we're looking for, but what is it picking up that we're not seeing when you look at everything together in that way? And we're already starting to see some really interesting hints of things that we hadn't spotted before, and more applied tools like, can we port this sort of technology that we've been developing with Colossal to look at elephant behavior from above, to map it onto another stream of work that we're doing to use artificial intelligence to help us survey wildlife populations, not just elephants, counting wildlife in open savanna areas from aircraft. That's a very time-consuming and expensive process at the moment. AI and maybe drones one day, but certainly light aircraft can really help when helped by artificial intelligence. And it may be we can get to a point using these AI tools where survey flights like that don't just count how many of which species, but they're actually able to give us demographics of the elephants, age structure of herds, body conditions, perhaps. You know, it's really is opening up a great deal. And I think where this gets important for conservation is that it is starting to feed data on the natural world into these artificial intelligence systems. And if we want our robot overlords to pay attention to nature when they take over, we need them to pay attention. We need to give them the data. We need sensors out there But joking aside, this stuff is going to be really important for what I hope will be a major future funding stream for conservation and for the natural world, which is in this speculative at the moment realm of biodiversity credits. Measuring nature and how nature is doing is critical to this effort of creating financial models that will allow the world to invest in places that still have biodiversity.
It's interesting that you mention funding and financing here. There are many people out there and many people who are listening here today that love and admire elephants but could be unsure how to help. How are some ways the average person can get involved in elephant conservation efforts?
So I think when it comes to getting involved in elephant conservation, not everyone lives alongside elephants and can help directly, but the world doesn't. We do need the world to be behind elephants if they're going to have a solid future. The lowest rung, I guess, would be, first rung is just educate yourself, follow, share the organization, share the news from the organizations that are on the ground, get behind campaigns when you see them, be an advocate for elephants, but also be a stand up and be engaged in your natural in the natural environment that surrounds you. Use your vote, use your voice in local situations and to whatever level you can get. Coming to visit elephants, more expensive, more involved. If it's a dream come true for most people, if you know, given the chance to come and visit elephants, it's the most wonderful thing to come and do. Even if you've seen lots of elephant movies on TV or visited elephants in a safari park, seeing them in the wild, in their natural environment, is life-changing experience for most. So highly encourage that. Donations, of course, are incredible. We run probably the most powerful conservation initiative that I've been a part of. I think Ian feels the same, was when we started something called the Elephant Crisis Fund, which is a collaborative way of getting funding out to the myriad different groups across Africa. These are sometimes very small, deeply embedded, highly experienced groups that don't have fundraising networks, but that do very important work on the ground. We raise money for these groups and that give 100% of that money on to these partners. And we run this with the wonderful Wildlife Conservation Network in the US. This is I bring it up in this context because these groups, you can get an incredible amount done with a very small amount of money. So don't think that just because organizations have big budgets and that your ability to donate is small, $10, $50, $100, same in pounds, this goes a long way. So donations, especially regular donations, are an enormous help to the people that are doing this work, keeping rangers on the front line, keeping counter-trafficking people on the case. It's hugely important.
You've brought up some amazing topics there that I'm just going to put a note on because I really want to jump back into. But I just wanted to ask a quick question about how active Save the Elephants is with local communities in the region. Could you give us a bit more information about your elephant scholarships and how have you seen the community involvement contribute to elephant conservation success? And where do you want to see this to continue to grow?
So communities are people that live with elephants in Africa are... they hold the future of elephants in their hands. Their future will be determined by what these people think and feel about elephants. These communities are either in pastoralist areas, they're often living in amongst the elephants, or around in places with national parks, they are surrounding the parks. They need to feel the benefits of having elephants around, and we need to minimize the downsides to these communities from elephants. So we need to give them the tools to live in peace and the tools for elephants to benefit people. In Kenya, take where I am now, only 10% of the country is covered with national parks, reserves, protected forests. If Kenya is going to meet the UN Sustainable Development Goal of 30% country, we need other areas. And this is where there's a good news story in Kenya, in that Kenya is a leader in community conservation. There are about 230 or more community conservation areas in Kenya, and they make up another 16% of Kenya's land. So we're actually not far off that 30% target. But how effective these community conservancies are for wildlife very much depends on how engaged they are in how much they're feeling the benefits of elephants and other biodiversity and how much they're not seeing the downsides. So Communities are the key. How you do it is critical.
Amazing.
So I was going to tell you about our elephant scholarship. You also asked about our elephant scholarship. So this was when, say, the elephants arrived in Samburu for the first time in northern Kenya. And we said, look, we'd like to start studying the elephants. Will you give us a place to stay? And said, what do you guys need? And said, we'd like education. That's the number one thing that the nomads of Samburu wanted. One of the initiatives we started was with these elephant scholarships. Now, what we saw is that there are a lot of very bright kids from very needy families across this elephant range. So we started recruiting the brightest, if they had no other means, and then not just funding their school fees, but also making sure that all the other barriers to their education were removed as well. So we'd get them to school, we'd give them the uniform. Crucially, in the holidays, instead of just letting them go back to spend their whole holiday herding goats where the knowledge of maths trickles away and they forget it all, we do booster camps for a couple of weeks in all holidays, provide work experience and internships and so on. And this has been incredibly powerful for the 150 or so kids that have gone through this. And we've got kids coming out with international masters, now international PhDs. And these guys are very much going to be part of the future conservation leadership in this country and around the world. I think it's a critical thing to do. And they are 100% ambassadors for elephants. They see the linkage between the opportunity they've been given and elephants very, very clearly. The other important thing alongside this is that we can't just support the brightest. There are other people that need support too. And one of the things that sadly does happen every now and then is people find themselves in conflict with an elephant. A kid ends up herding his goats in the wrong place and maybe falls afoul of an elephant, gets injured, or God forbid, a family member killed. We will give, as you can never compensate, but to console these families, we will give bursaries for their kids to get them to school and say, you know, this is an apology from the elephants.
Wow. Okay. That's okay. I guess that must be so deeply impactful for the families. We're running so short on time here. I was just going through my questions thinking, what can I kind of ram together at the end that I really want to get across? I want to just jump back into the ways that people could get involved in elephant conservation. And one thing that you mentioned was coming to Africa and actually seeing elephants in the wild. So responsible and ecotourism is something that I've discussed a lot on the show. Do you think this form of tourism can be a force for good in elephant conservation? And if so, how? But are there a lot of misconceptions that people have regarding this elephant tourism, this elephant ecotourism? And do you think it can have negative effects? And how can we combat these negative effects? And I'm aware that was a very loaded question, but I hope that you're able to give me some insight there.
Yeah, I think I haven't heard of too many negative effects for elephant tourism in responsible elephant tourism in Africa. Certainly elephant riding in India, and the very different situation with Asian elephants, where you've got elephants that have been or made captive, let's say, and perhaps taken out of a life of servitude in the forest and put into a life of servitude carrying tourists around. It's awful what elephants are put through in order to have them be okay with that. And I think yes, we need to, people definitely shouldn't be riding elephants, and that kind of, we need to stay away very much from that. The African context is different. I think the dangers are that there are a lot of people in the world and not many places with elephants, and those places can quickly get overrun. But I think we're quite far from that at the moment. I think that the main danger is that people seem to concentrate in areas that, the few areas that are really spectacular, and that they're not going to the other areas. But I don't really see that as a danger, because I think there's a lot more places that people could go, and other species are actually much more impacted by that sort of heavy impact tourism, like lions or cheetahs can really suffer. Elephants will just move away, and because they feed on grass, they're not so I think ecotourism is a really, really valuable element in the mix. I think that the main problem I see is that African conservation is too dependent on tourism. And as we saw in COVID, a lot of conservation efforts really struggled to get through COVID because people weren't traveling. And when you build your conservation edifice and you're paying all your salaries and your rangers from the
model of tourism,
tourism, we're in trouble. And that's why we're very keen on the prospects for carbon-based funding or biodiversity-based funding, just to broaden the pot. But we need people involved, and we need the communities that we were talking about earlier to be able to be, be showing off what they've been able to conserve and that the rest of the world has lost. And so that there's a very multifaceted benefit of tourism when it's done right.
I really wish I could dive into these alternative funding sources with you here today, but we are running right down to the wire. And I really want to end with asking, what is the most important thing that you want listeners to take away from our chat here today? And what message of hope and encouragement would you like to share with them?
I think, you know, these are bleak times right now, with climate change really showing its teeth, and a feeling that we don't have the political leadership that we need to deal with it. But I think that everyone needs to remember that we're not standing still either. You know, our world is changing for the better as we have these challenges. So I think I would love to leave people with the sense of wonder that these creatures can give you, and the knowledge that, yes, people have endangered elephants, but we've also learned a lot about them, and we've saved them. We've come together as a global community, and we've stopped the ivory trade in its tracks, and we still have elephants on this planet, and they are 130 million years separated from us, but they share so much with us in terms of how they live their lives and the intricacies of their society, and I think the depth of their intelligence, and we're developing new tools to discover more and more about their world, and it just makes me really excited for the future. Alongside all the dread of the bad things that are happening, I think we're gonna find extraordinary new things as our artificial intelligence and other tools helps us delve into their world and experience what it's like to be an elephant. I think our sense of wonder will deepen, and I think everyone should be excited, if you're interested in the natural world and the environment, poised to find out so much more about it and about these other worlds of these other creatures. It's also an exciting time to be alive.
And where can listeners learn more about Save the Elephants?
Well, we've got a great website, savetheelephants.org. We also have a new film on Ian Douglas Hamilton that's just been bought by Channel 4 that will be coming out later this year, called A Life Among Elephants. It's a very wonderful story about how humans and elephants can be friends and how we can come together to help each other. There's a wonderful film we were part of called The Elephant Queen, which is on Apple, which is a film by Mark Diebel and Vicky Stone, two of the world's greatest natural history filmmakers, that explores all the ways in which ecosystems depend on elephants through a very powerful story of an elephant matriarch called Athena leading her family across the savannah. These are all great ways, but yeah, there's lots about this online. Come and see one of our presentations. Come to these films. Watch these films. Come and see us in Samburu if you can. And come and meet these elephants.
Thank you so much, Frank, for speaking with me today. And thank you all for listening to Our Altered World. If you enjoy the show, I'd love for you to visit our website, ouralteredworld.com, where you can join our community and find more information on upcoming shows. You can also find some of my work on social media at Flunking Monkey, FlunkingMonkey. And until next time, I hope you all have a great day.